There is barely anyone in our dying town, and it's literally Arctic temperatures. But I left my coat at school, and when I finally get home, I am totally alone. So I get into bed and sleep until Mum wakes me for dinner, not having any idea that I ran away from school. That evening, Charlie has an appointment with his psychiatrist at the hospital, and we all decide to go. Mum, Dad, and me. So we leave Oliver at home with Nick babysitting. Mum and Dad go in for a meeting first, leaving Charlie and me to wait in the visiting room. This is the first time I've been to the hospital since Charlie stayed here last year, and it's still just as creepily optimistic. On the wall, there is a big painting of a rainbow and the sun with a smiley face. The adolescent ward has patients with every type of mental illness. Currently with us in the room is an anorexic girl reading The Hunger Games, and the irony of this is too cruel to laugh at. There is also a younger boy, perhaps 13, watching Shrek and cackling manically at everything Donkey says. Charlie has not talked to me since Friday, but I haven't talked to him either. After several minutes, he breaks our silence. Why haven't we been talking? He's wearing a loose-fitting check shirt and jeans. His eyes are dark and dead. I don't know, is all I can say. You're angry at me. I'm definitely not. You should be. I fold my legs up on the sofa. It's not like it's your fault. Then whose fault is it? He leans on one hand. Who is responsible for this? No one, I snap. Shit happens. Shit happens to the wrong people. You know that. He looks at me for a long time, head slightly lowered. He's holding on to his shirt sleeves, so I can't see his wrists. What have you been up to? He asks. I pause before telling him. I was with Michael Holden all weekend. He raises his eyebrows. Not like that, I say. Well, I didn't say anything. But you were thinking it. Why were you with him all weekend? Are you friends now? His eyes glimmer. I didn't think you did that. I frown. He told me I was a manically depressed psychopath. I don't think he... The water machine bubbles. The windows are open a crack, and they are rattling the 1980s blinds. Charlie looks at me. What else is happening? He asks. We haven't talked properly in ages. I list the things. Becky is going out with Ben Hope. She talks about him all the time. I haven't talked to Mum and Dad properly since Saturday. I haven't been sleeping a lot. And Michael. Charlie nods. That's a lot of things. I know, a real array of first world problems. In the corridor outside the visiting lounge, the emergency alarm begins to sound, signifying that somewhere in the building a patient needs to be restrained. I watch through the blinds as a girl runs past, wailing, only to be pursued and leapt on by three large care assistants. It's almost comical. Charlie doesn't even blink. Hang on, he says. Becky is going out with Ben Hope. Yeah? Ben Hope, who used to go to Truam. Do you know him? The question almost appears to startle him. After a short pause, he says, Yeah, we used to be friends. Not really anymore, though. Okay. I'm staying off school tomorrow as well. Yeah? Yeah. Mum and Dad are making me. They're blowing this kind of out of proportion. I snort. I found you in the kitchen covered in blood, idiot. He leans back. Well, aren't I a fabulous drama queen? Do you want me to get the bus with you on Wednesday? Usually I walk to school and Charlie gets the bus. I hate the bus. Charlie's expression softens and he smiles. Yeah, thanks. He adjusts himself on the sofa so that his body is facing me. I think you should give Michael a chance. A chance? I know Nick and I said he's weird, and he is weird, and I know you think that it's easier to be by yourself. But every minute you spend thinking about what you're not doing, that's another minute forgetting about how to be around other people. I don't. Michael's okay. He's proven that. I don't understand why you can't accept things like this. If you can't accept things you don't understand, then you'll spend your life questioning everything. Then you'll have to live out your life in your own head. We're interrupted by a nurse, who enters the room and asks Charlie to join Mum and Dad in the meeting. Charlie stands up but doesn't walk off. He looks down at me. Is that a bad thing? I ask. He blinks slowly, eyes flickering to the anorexic reading the Hunger Games. Victoria, that is how you end up in a place like this. Chapter 19. The fire alarm goes off in period 5 the next day. I had just settled into a seat in the common room, iPod playing Fix You by Coldplay over and over on repeat. Pathetic, I know, when the siren began to wail. Now we're all here in the freezing wasteland of the school field, lined up in our form groups. I hear at least 3 people say something about a fire in Kent's office, but having been at an all-girl school for over 5 years, I've learnt not to trust anything by word of mouth. No one I really know is in my form, so I shiver and look around. I see Michael in a form a few lines away, sort of out of place among the year 13s. He looks sort of out of place everywhere. I start to wonder whether my outburst on Sunday is the reason why he hasn't called me or looked for me at school. I wonder whether he'll still want to be friends. Maybe I should listen to Charlie. If he thinks that Michael is okay, then he probably is, and I should give him a chance. Not that that matters, because I declined his offer anyway. It's not like he's going to give me another chance. That's okay. That's fine. I don't want to go to that solitaire meet-up this Saturday, so I've at least gotten out of that. I keep looking at him because there's something not quite right. With half-shut eyes, he's staring blankly into a book, and his face is so frozen that it makes me tense up. In fact, I almost think he's about to cry. I can't quite see what the book is called, but it's very thick and he's nearly at the end. Also, his tie isn't tied. He's wrapped it around his neck like a scarf, and his side part is much too far over. I wish I knew what he was reading. I know I don't like books, but you can always tell what someone is thinking by what they're reading. A little way off, Lucas wanders onto the field with Evelyn and an anonymous boy with large hair, part of the last group to arrive. Lucas looks equally sad. I begin to feel that everyone is sad. Everything is sad. All sad. I wonder whether Lucas is Evelyn's secret boyfriend. It's possible. I don't want to think about Lucas or Michael anymore. I withdraw my phone and load up the solitaire blog. I can at least have another look at Jake Gyllenhaal. He is a beautiful human being. But there's a new post that's overtaken Jake. It's a photo of a hand, maybe a girl's, but potentially a boy's, forefinger outstretched, just about to break the glass of a school fire alarm button. Underneath, the text reads, "Do I dare disturb the universe?" I stare at the photo for a long time, and I start to feel a bit claustrophobic. That question, those 2 lines of poetry, keep spinning around my head like it's asking it of me. I get to wondering how I even know that those 2 lines came from a poem, because I don't think I've even glanced at a poem that hasn't been part of schoolwork. I then wonder whether I could ask Michael. because he would probably know what poem it was from. But then I remember that he thinks I'm a manically depressed psychopath. So that is the end of that. Chapter 20. I get home. Everything normal happens. I say hello to Nick and Charlie. I turn on my laptop. I put a film on. And then I do something weird. I call Michael. 16:49 p.m. Outgoing call. M. Hello? T. Hi, it's Tori. M. Tori? Really? You called me again? That's twice in a fortnight. You do not strike me as one who enjoys making phone calls. T. Believe me, I'm not. M. T. I overreacted. I'm the one who has to say sorry. I called to say sorry. M. T. M. I'm sorry too. I don't think you're a psychopath. T. Don't you? It's a valid assumption. M. I don't even know why we need to apologize to each other. I can't even remember what we're arguing about. I don't even think we did argue. T. Are you in denial? M. Are you? T. What does that mean? M. I don't know. T. I'm just sorry I snapped at you. M. T. I do want to be friends with you. Can we? M. We're already friends, Tori. You don't need to ask. We're already friends. T. M. Is Charlie all right? T. He's all right. M. Are you all right? T. I'm fine. M. T. M. I see Becky and Ben are pretty snug together. T. Oh, yeah, they're practically conjoined. She's really happy. M. Are you happy? T. What? M. Are you happy? T. Yeah, I'm happy for her. I'm happy for her. She's my best friend. I'm really happy for her. M. That's not what I asked. T. I don't get it. M. T. M. Will you still come to the solitaire meetup with me on Saturday? T. M. I don't want to go alone. T. Yeah. M. You'll come? T. Yes. M. T. Why can I hear wind? Where are you? M. I'm at the rink. T. The ice rink? M. Do you know any other rinks? T. You're on the phone and skating at the same time. M. Men can multitask too, you know. Where are you? T. Obviously at home. M. Such a loser. T. What's that music that's playing? M. T. That's film music, isn't it? M. Is it? T. It's from Gladiator. It's called Now We Are Free. M. T. M. Your film knowledge is simply magical. T. Magical? M. You're magical, Tori. T. You're the one who can ice skate. That's the closest thing to flying a human can do without a vehicle. M. T. You can fly, Michael. M. T. What? M. I can fly. T. You can fly. M. No one's ever. T. M. I'd better meet you at Hogwarts then. T. Or Neverland, M. Or both, T. Or both. Chapter 21. Sitting next to Charlie on the Wednesday morning bus journey calms me. I have a lot of unread messages on my blog, but I don't want to read them. It's much, much too sunny today. We meet Nick outside Truam. Nick gives Charlie a quick kiss, and they start talking to each other, laughing. I watch him and Charlie walk in, and then head up the road to Higgs. I'm feeling sort of all right because Michael and I are okay now. I don't know why I made all that fuss the other day. No, that's a lie. I do know why. It's because I'm an idiot. Mr. Compton, my unintelligible imbecile of a math teacher, decides, for one lesson only, that we need to work in pairs with people we do not usually sit with. This is how I end up sitting next to Ben Hope in Wednesday's Period 1 maths lesson. We exchange pleasantries and then sit in silence while Compton begins to explain the trapezium rule in the most complicated way imaginable. Ben does not have a pencil case. He carries a pen and a small ruler in his breast pocket. He has also forgotten his textbook. I feel that this may have been deliberate. Halfway through, Compton leaves to photocopy some sheets and does not return for some time. To my dismay, Ben decides that he needs to talk to me. "Hey," he says, "how's Charlie doing?" I turn my head slowly to the left. Surprisingly, he looks genuinely concerned. Truth? Lie? "Not too bad," Ben nods. "Yeah, okay. Charlie said you used to be friends or something." His eyes open very wide. Yeah, I guess, but you know, like, yeah, everyone knows Charlie, you know? "Yeah, everyone knows. You don't stay off school for 3 months without everyone finding out why." "Yeah." The silence between us returns. The rest of our class are chattering and it is nearly the end of the lesson. Has Compton been eaten by the photocopier? I suddenly find myself talking. Talking first. This is pretty rare. "Everyone loves Charlie at Truam," I say, "don't they?" Ben begins to tap his pen on the table. A weirdly nervous grin spreads across his face. "Well, I wouldn't say everyone exactly," he scoffs. I frown at him and he quickly covers himself with, "No, I mean, like, people can't be liked by everyone, right?" I clear my throat. "I guess not." "I don't know him anymore, really," he says. "Yeah, okay." Usually people like Charlie, nice people, are forgotten. Usually the popular people are the loudest and funniest, the ones with the opinions, with the outfits, with the big smiles and crushing hugs. Nice people are vulnerable because they don't know how to be mean. They don't know how to put themselves at the top. And you would think that it would be someone like Nick who is at the top at Truam. Loud, attractive, house captain, rugby player. But no, it's Charlie. What I'm trying to say is that Charlie is a nice person. And despite everything I've just explained, everybody seems to love him. And I think that is a modern miracle. Chapter 22. Lunch, common room. I am staring into my reflection in a smudgy blank computer screen with my head in my hands. Not because I'm particularly stressed or anything. This is just a very comfortable sitting position. "Hello," says Lucas, smiling and sitting in the chair next to me. I look up at him. He doesn't look so embarrassed today, which is colossal progress. "Why so cheerful?" I ask. He shrugs. "Why not?" I roll my eyes, faking sarcasm. I don't like your attitude. He stares at me for a minute or so. I take out my phone and scroll through my blog feed. Then he says, Hey, what are you up to on Saturday? Nothing, I guess. Do you... We should do something. We should? Yeah. Now he's embarrassed. I mean, if you want. Like what? He shakes his head. I don't know. Just chill somewhere. I force myself to think very carefully about this. I could try, for once. I could try to be a legitimately nice human being. Oh, I said I'd go to this thing in the evening, but I'm free in the day. He lights up. Great, what do you want to do? I don't know, it was your idea. Oh, yeah, well, you could come round mine if you want, just watch movies. Is Evelyn all right with that? Yep, I went there. He sort of laughs, like I'm joking. What? Evelyn? My voice starts to fail. Are you not... You and Evelyn... We're... No. Okay, right. Cool, just checking. What are you guys talking about? Becky calls over to us. We both spin around in our chairs. You look like you're talking about something interesting. I want gossip. Spill. I put my legs up on Lucas's lap because I just can't be asked to be reserved right now. Obviously we're flirting. God, Becky. For a second, Becky thinks I'm serious. It is a truly triumphant moment. Later, I pass Michael in the corridor. He stops and points directly at me. You, he says. Me, I say. We speedily transfer our conversation to a stairwell. Are you free on Saturday? He asks. He's got one of his stupid mugs of tea again. He's actually spilt some on his white shirt. I'm about to say yes, but then I remember. No. I said me and Lucas would do something. Sorry. Ah, don't worry. He sips his tea. You're not allowed to ditch the solitaire meetup, though. Oh. You forgot, didn't you? I'm surprised you remembered. Well, everyone's been talking about it. They have? We look at each other. Do I have to go? I say. You are aware that I literally don't give a single fuck about solitaire. I am aware, he says, which means, yes, I do have to go. The horde of lower school girls thundering up the stairs behind us is slowly thinning. I need to get to English. Anyway, he says, yes, get to mine Saturday evening, when you and Lucas are finished canoodling. He moves his eyebrows up and down. I slowly shake my head. I don't think I have ever heard anyone use that word in real life. Well then, he says, I'm glad I've made your day that bit more special. Chapter 23. In my younger years, every day after school, I used to walk down the road and meet Charlie outside Truam. We'd then either ride the bus home or we would walk. Despite it only being a 10-minute bus journey, I would have to put my iPod on near full volume. I knew that I would be deaf by the time I was 20, but if I had to listen to these kids every single day, I don't think I'd make it to 20. I don't think I'd make it to 17. Still, despite my two-year-long bus boycott, I started getting the bus again on Wednesday to keep Charlie company. And it hasn't been too bad so far. We've had a good chance to talk about stuff. I don't mind talking with Charlie. Anyway, it's Friday today, and Michael has decided that he is coming home with me. Which is sort of nice, to tell you the truth. Nick is waiting for me outside Truam. Nick always looks particularly dashing in his tie and blazer. The rugby patch above his school crest reflects a little sunlight. He is wearing sunglasses, Ray-Bans. He sees Michael and me approach. Aight? Nick nods, hands in pockets, Adidas bag strapped across his chest. All right, I say. Nick studies Michael. Michael Holden, he says. Michael has his hands held behind his back. You're Nick Nelson. I see Nick's initial uncertainty ease at Michael's uncharacteristically normal reaction. Yep, yeah, I remember you, from Truam. You're infamous, man. Yes, yeah, I'm awesome. Rad. Michael smiles. Nicholas Nelson, you have a really excellent name. Nick laughs in that warm way of his, almost as if he and Michael have been friends for years. I know, right? Flocks of Truam boys soar past us, running for inexplicable reasons, while the traffic on the road is unmoving. A group of Year 10 Higgs girls cozy up to a group of Year 10 Truam boys against the gate several meters away from us. There are at least three couples within the group. God. I scratch my forehead, feeling agitated. Where's Charlie? Nick raises his eyebrows and turns back toward Truam. He's the only guy in his class who cares about classics, so he's probably been dragged into a long conversation with Rogers about, like, Greek proverbs or something. Tori! I twirl around. Becky is dodging traffic and skipping my way, her purple locks flailing behind her. When she arrives, she says, Ben said he had to go to Truam and get something from last year, coursework or something, so I'm just going to wait with you guys. I don't want to stand by myself like a Larry. I smile. It's starting to become really difficult to do that sometimes around Becky, but I make the effort and force it. Michael and Nick are both staring at her with empty expressions that I can't read. What are you all doing here? We're waiting for Charlie, I say. Oh, yeah? Shall we just go in and find him? Nick suggests. He's being majorly slow. But none of us moves. It's like we're in Waiting for Godot, murmurs Michael. I've heard of the play, but I haven't got any idea what Michael is talking about. And as if things could not get any more awkward, Lucas appears out of nowhere. Nick raises his arms. Lucas, mate! They embrace in a manly sort of hug, but Lucas just looks silly. They proceed to exchange pleasantries, and each of them uses the words mate and man far too many times, resulting in Michael snorting, Oh my God, much too loudly. Fortunately, Lucas and Nick appear not to hear. I chuckle faintly. What are you all doing here? Asks Lucas, deliberately pretending not to see Michael. Waiting for Charlie, says Nick. Waiting for Ben, says Becky. Why don't you just go look for them? I've got to go inside too, to pick up my art GCSE coursework. That's what Ben's doing, says Becky. At the repeated mention of Ben, Nick seems to frown at Becky. But I might just be imagining it. Well, let's go then, he says, and pushes his sunglasses farther up his nose. We can't, whispers Michael, oozing sarcasm, so quiet that only I hear. Why not? We're waiting for Charlie. Ah. He might be quoting, but I haven't read or seen Waiting for Godot, so it's lost on me. Nick turns on the spot and walks into the school. Becky follows immediately, then the rest of us. I remember instantly why I chose not to go to this school for sixth form. The boys who pass us are more than strangers. I feel trapped. As we enter the main building, the walls seem to creep higher and higher, and the light bars are dim and flashing, and I experience a brief flashback of the back of Michael's head, leading me toward the Truam Maths classroom last year. Every so often, we pass these rusty old radiators, none of which appears to be emitting any heat. I start to shiver. God, it's like an abandoned mental asylum, isn't it? Michael is on my left. I'd forgotten what it's like here. It's as if they built it out of misery. We wind through corridors that appear to materialize in front of our feet. Michael starts whistling. Truant boys give us a lot of funny looks, particularly Michael. One group of older boys shout, "Oi, Michael Holden, wanker!" And Michael spins on the spot and produces a strong double thumbs up in their direction. We pass through a set of double doors and find ourselves in a large maze of lockers, not unlike our own Higgs locker room. It seems empty at first, until we hear a voice. "What the fuck did you say to them?" All five of us freeze. The voice continues, "Because I don't remember saying that you could spread lies about me to your retard sister." Whoever else is there murmurs something inaudible. I already know who it is. I think everyone already knows who it is. I spot Becky's face. I haven't seen that expression on her for a very long time. "Do not make me laugh. I bet you couldn't wait to run and tell someone. Everyone knows you're just an attention-seeking prick. Everyone knows you're doing it for the attention, and you're telling your sister lies about us so she can spread shit around. You think you're so much better than everyone because you don't eat, and now you're back at school, and even though you haven't even looked at me since you hooked up with that rugby gay, you think you can spread shit about me that isn't even fucking true." "I don't know what you think you've heard," says Charlie, louder now, "but I literally haven't told anyone. Anyway, I seriously can't believe you're still terrified of people finding out." There is a sharp smack and a crash. I start running toward the voices before I realize what I'm doing, and I turn the corner of a locker row and Charlie is crumpled on the floor. Ben Hope is in some kind of rage, just hitting Charlie's face. And there's blood, and Nick tackles Ben in his side, and the pair topples down the row and into the wall at the end. And I'm kneeling down by Charlie, and I'm holding my hands up by his face, not daring to touch him. But his eyes are barely open, and I think I'm shaking, and everything seems a bit, I don't know. And Nick is screaming, "I'll kill you," over and over. And then Michael and Lucas are dragging Nick away. And I'm still just sort of sitting there, with my little brother, with my shaking hands, wishing that I hadn't woken up this morning. I hadn't woken up yesterday. I hadn't ever woken up. "That dick deserves it," Ben shouts, panting. "He's a fucking liar." "He didn't even say anything to me," I say, calm at first. Then I'm screaming it. "He didn't even say anything to me!" Everyone is silent. Ben is breathing heavily. What I thought was attractive about him has now died and been cremated. Michael kneels down with me, leaving Nick in the care of Lucas. He clicks his fingers lightly next to Charlie's ear. Charlie stirs and his eyes open. "Do you know my name?" asks Michael. Not Michael anymore, someone entirely different, someone serious, someone all-knowing. After a pause, Charlie croaks, "Michael Holden." Then he grins manically. "Holden, funny." Something changes in Nick, and in one swift movement, he's down on the floor with us. He takes Charlie into his arms. "Do we need to take him to hospital? What hurts?" Charlie lifts his hand, waves a finger at his face, then drops it. "I think I'm fine." "Maybe he's concussed," says Nick. "I don't want to go to the hospital," says Charlie firmly. His eyes have focused. I look around. Becky appears to have vanished, and Ben is struggling to his feet, and Lucas doesn't seem to know what to do with himself. Charlie stands up surprisingly quickly. He wipes away a smear of blood. He'll have bruises, but at least his nose is still straight. He looks at Ben. Ben looks back, and that's when I see it in Ben's eyes. Fear. I'm not going to tell, says Charlie, because I'm not a dick like you. Ben snorts, but Charlie ignores it. But I think that you should at least try and be honest with yourself, even if you can't be honest with everyone else. It's just sad, you know? Get away from me, Ben snarls, but his voice wobbles, sort of like he's on the verge of tears. Just fuck off with your boyfriend, for fuck's sake. Nick very nearly lunges for the second time, but I see him fight to stop himself. Ben catches my eye as we leave. I stare at him and his expression changes from hatred to what I hope might be regret. I doubt it. I want to be sick. I try to think of something to say to him, but nothing summarizes it. I hope I'm making him want to die. Someone places a hand around my arm, and I turn my head. Come on, Tori, says Lucas. So I do. On our way out, Lucas with a hand on my back, Nick and Michael supporting Charlie, who is still a bit wobbly, we pass Becky, who has for some reason pushed herself to the end of another locker row. We lock eyes. I know she's going to break up with Ben. She has to break up with Ben. She must have heard everything. She's my best friend. Charlie is my brother. I don't understand what has happened. Should we feel sorry for Ben? Someone asks. Maybe Michael. Why are there no happy people? Someone else asks. Maybe me. Chapter 24. Someone calls me on my mobile at 9:04 a.m., but I am in bed and my phone is more than an arm's length away, so I just let it ring on. At 9:15 a.m., someone rings the house phone, and Charlie comes into my room, but I keep my eyes closed and pretend I'm still asleep, and Charlie goes away. My bed whispers at me to stay. My curtains bar out daytime. At 2:34 p.m., Dad throws my door open and huffs and mutters and I suddenly feel sick. So after another 5 minutes, I go downstairs and sit on the sofa in the living room. Mum comes in to get some washing. Are you going to get dressed? She asks. No, Mum. I'm never going to get dressed ever again. I'm going to live in my pajamas until my death. She doesn't say anything else. She leaves. Dad comes into the living room. Alive, then? I say nothing, because I do not feel alive. Dad sits next to me. Are you going to tell me what's wrong? No, I am not. You know, if you want to be happier, you have to try. You have to put in the effort. Your problem is that you don't try. I do try. I have tried. I have tried for 16 years. Where's Charlie? I ask. Round Nick's. Dad shakes his head. Still can't believe Charlie got himself hit in the face with a cricket bat. That kid really does attract misfortune. I do not say anything. Are you going to go out today? No. Why not? What about Michael? You could spend the day with him again. I don't really reply, and Dad looks at me. What about Becky? I haven't seen her around here for quite a while. I don't reply again. He sighs and rolls his eyes. Teenagers, he says, as if the mere state of being a teenager explains every single thing about me. And then he leaves, huffing and puffing and sighing. I sit under my duvet on my bed, a diet lemonade in one hand and my phone in the other. I find Michael's number in my contacts and press the green button. I don't know why I'm calling him. I think it might be Dad's fault. It goes straight to voicemail. I drop the phone on the bed and roll over, so I am completely buried by the covers. Of course I can't expect him to just show up any old time. He has a life after all. He has a family and coursework and stuff. His entire existence doesn't revolve around mine. I am a narcissist. I rummage around the sheets and eventually locate my laptop. I flip it up. If ever in doubt about anything, my first port of call is always Google. And I am certainly in doubt about everything. I type Michael Holden into the search bar and press enter. Michael Holden isn't an overly uncommon name. Lots of other Michael Holdens show up, particularly MySpace pages. Since when was MySpace still a thing? Lots of Twitters also show up. But I can't find my Michael Holden's Twitter. He doesn't seem to be the sort of guy who would have Twitter. I sigh and close my laptop. At least I tried. And then, as if I'd summoned him with the closing of my laptop, my phone begins to ring. I pick it up. Michael Holden's name glares on the screen. With a kind of enthusiasm entirely unknown to me, I press the green button. Hello? Tori, what is up? It seems to take me longer than necessary to say something in reply. Not a lot. Behind Michael's voice, the low chatter of a crowd can be heard. Where are you? I ask. What's happening? This time, it is he who pauses. Oh, yeah, I didn't tell you, did I? I'm at the rink. Oh, do you have practice or something? No, it's, I've got a sort of competition today. A competition? Yeah. What competition? He pauses again. It's the National Youth Speed Skating Semifinals. My stomach gives up. Look, I've got to go. I promise I'll call you when it's finished, yeah? And then I'll see you tonight. Yeah. Okay, talk later. He hangs up the phone. I remove it from my ear and stare at it. National Youth Speed Skating Semifinals. That's not just some stupid local competition. That's important. That's what he was going to invite me to today, but I'd said no. I'd said I was hanging out with Lucas. And then I decided to avoid him anyway. Without any further hesitation, I leap out of bed. I park Charlie's bike outside the rink. It's 4:32 p.m. and dark. I've probably missed it. I don't know why I even tried, but I did. How long are speed skate races? Why didn't Michael tell me about this before? I run, yes, actually run, through the empty foyer and the double doors into the stadium. A scattering of supporters fills the stadium seating around the rink. And to my right, psyched-up skaters sit on benches. Some of them could be 16. Some could be 25. I am not good at judging boys' ages. I walk closer to the plastic casing of the rink and make my way around until I find the gate where the casing isn't so high. I stare over. There is a race going on. For a moment, I don't know where I'm looking or who I'm looking for, because they all look exactly the same in these ridiculous suits that are like cat suits and rounded helmets. 8 guys blast past me, and the rush of air tears at my face and my hair that I definitely forgot to sort out before I left the house. And they lean round the corners of the rink, so close to the ice, brushing it with their fingertips. I don't understand how they don't just fall over. When they pass me the second time, that's when I see him. He turns his head, showing me his bulbous eyes behind large goggles and a ridiculously concrete expression. The eyes find me and his body turns, his hair swept backward, and his face, beyond surprised, stays parallel to mine. I know instantly that something has changed. He stares. At me, maybe. His whole face expands. It illuminates, and all else seems to fade into fog. And I place a hand against the plastic casing, and everything inside me rushes to my feet. I'm not sure if he really sees me. I don't cheer. I just stand there. He pulls out in front. The crowd screams, but then some other blur of boy flies from the group, and he's reached Michael, and he's past Michael, and I realize that the race is over, and Michael has come second. I back away from the rink and shelter myself slightly behind the stands as the skaters make their way to the gate. Older men in tracksuits greet the boys, and one of them pats Michael on the back. But something is wrong. Something is very wrong. Something about Michael is wrong. He's not Michael Holden. He's removed his skates and goggles. He takes off his helmet and gloves and drops them onto the floor. His face contorts into a kind of scrunched-up snarl. His fists curl so his skin drains of color, and he storms past the man and tramps over to the benches. He reaches a row of lockers and looks into them, blankly, chest visibly expanding and contracting. With an almost terrifying malice, he throws a crazed punch at the lockers, wailing a subdued howl of rage. Turning, he hurls a kick at a pile of racing helmets, scattering them about the floor. He clutches his hair, as if trying to pull it out. I've never seen Michael like this. I know I shouldn't be so surprised. I haven't even known Michael for 3 weeks. But my perceptions of people rarely change, and when they do, it's never this drastic. It's weird how you see someone who smiles all the time and you assume that they are happy all the time. It's weird how someone is nice to you and you assume that they're a wholly good person. I did not think Michael could be so serious about something, or so angry. It's like watching your dad cry. What scares me the most, though, is that absolutely no person in this entire swarm of human beings seems to notice. So I barge my way toward him. I'm furious. I hate all these people for not caring. I'm hurling them out of the way as I walk, Michael Holden never leaving my eyesight. I reach him, breaking out of the crowd, and watch as he begins to manically attack some piece of paper that he had in his pocket. For several seconds, I don't really know what to do about it, but then find myself saying, "Yes, Michael Holden, tear that fucking paper." He drops everything, spins around, and points directly at me. The anger softens into sadness. "Tori," he says, but I don't hear it. I only see his mouth form the words. He's wearing a catsuit, and he's quite red, and his hair is slick with sweat, and his eyes are spinning in an electrified fury. But it's him. Neither of us really knows what to say. "You came second," I blurt eventually, pointlessly. "That's amazing." His expression, passive, sad, so odd, doesn't change. He retrieves his glasses from his pocket and puts them on. "I didn't win," he says. "I didn't qualify." He looks away. I think he's welling up a little. "I didn't think you were actually here," he says. "I thought I'd imagined you." A pause. "That's the first time you've called me Michael Holden." His chest is still moving quickly up and down. He looks older somehow in the spandex suit, and taller. The suit is mostly red with some orange and black areas. He has a whole life that I don't know about in this suit. Hundreds of hours on the ice, training, entering competitions, testing his stamina, trying to eat right. I don't know about any of that. I want to know. I open my mouth and close it several times. Do you get angry a lot? I say. I'm always angry, he says. Pause. Usually other things override it, but I'm always angry. And sometimes. His eyes drift vaguely to the right. Sometimes. The crowd buzzes, and I hate them even more. What happened to you and Lucas? He asks. I think about the phone calls that I'd been asleep for. Oh, yeah, no, that's not, no, I didn't feel very well. Oh, he says. You know, I don't actually like Lucas. Like that, I say. Okay, he says. We are silent for several long moments. Something in his face changes. It looks a bit like hope, but I can't really tell. Aren't you going to criticize me? He asks. Tell me that it's just a skating competition? That it doesn't mean anything? I ponder this. No, it means something. He smiles. I would say that he looks like the original Michael again. But he doesn't. There's something new in the smile. Happiness, he says, is the price of profound thought. Who's that a quote from? I ask. He winks. Me. And I'm alone again in this crowd, and I feel an odd feeling. It's not happiness. I know that it's brilliant that he came second in a national qualifier. But all I can think about is how Michael is just as good at lying as I am. Chapter 25. We fail to find out whose house it is, but the third house from the river bridge really is right on the river. The broad garden slopes into the water, which laps persistently at the dirt. There is an old canoe tied to a tree that hasn't been used for probably centuries. And over the river, you can see right across the flat countryside. The fields, darkened under the night, blend into the horizon, as if unsure themselves quite where the earth stops and the sky begins. This meet-up is not a meet-up. It is a house party. What had I been expecting? I had been expecting chairs, nibbles, a speaker, perhaps a PowerPoint presentation. The evening is cold, and it keeps trying to snow. I desperately want to be in my bed, and my stomach is all tight and tense. I hate parties. I always have. I always will. It's not even for the right reasons. I hate them, and I hate people who go to them. I have no justification. I'm just ridiculous. We walk past the smokers and into the open door. It's about 10 p.m. Music pounds. Clearly no one lives in this house. It's entirely bare of furniture, save for a couple of deck chairs set up in the living room and on the garden patio. And I'm aware of a kind of neutral colour scheme. The only thing giving the house any life at all is the impressive collection of artwork on the walls. There isn't any food, but there are bottles and colourful shot glasses everywhere. People are milling around in corridors and rooms, lots of them smoking cigarettes, lots of them smoking weed, very few of them sitting. Many of the girls I recognize from Higgs, though Michael does not suspect that any of these casual partygoers are the masterminds behind solitaire. There are older kids I don't recognize. Some must be 20, if not older. It makes me feel sort of nervous, to tell you the truth. I don't know why I'm here. I actually see the Year 11 girl from Becky's, the one who had come as Doctor Who. She's by herself, like last time, and she looks a little lost. She's walking very slowly along the corridor, without a drink, peering sadly at this painting of a wet cobbled street with red umbrellas and warm cafe windows. I wonder what she's thinking. I imagine that it's somewhat similar to what I'm thinking. She doesn't see me. The first people we find are Becky and Lauren. I should have guessed that they would come, seeing as they attend all the parties in this town. And I really should have guessed I'd find them smashed. Becky points at us with the hand that's not clasping a bottle. Oh my God, it's Tori and Michael, you guys! She whacks Lauren repeatedly on the arm. Lauren, 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 it's Sproulden! Lauren frowns. Mate, I thought we'd agreed on Maury or Tycho, she sighs. Man, your names just aren't good enough. Like, they don't work. They don't work like Klein or Ramione or Destiel or Mercer. They both giggle uncontrollably. I start to feel even more nervous. I didn't think you guys would be interested in solitaire. Becky waves the bottle, shrugging and rolling her eyes around. Hey, a party's a party's a party. I dunno. Some guy. But, like, it's solitaire. We've, like, infiltrated solitaire. She brings her finger up to her mouth. Shh. She drinks from the bottle. Listen, listen, do you know what song this is? We, like, cannot work it out. It smells like Teen Spirit, Nirvana. Oh, right, yeah, oh my God, I thought it was that. It does not say the song title in the lyrics. I look at Lauren, who's gazing around her in an awed wonder. You all right, Lauren? She comes back to earth and cackles at me. Isn't this party sick? She raises her arms in an I don't know gesture. It's snowing hot, guys, and the drinks are free. That's great for you, I say, the will to be a nice person slowly drifting away. She pretends not to hear me and they walk off, laughing at nothing. Michael and I circle the party. It's not like in films or Channel 4 teen dramas where everything slows down and turns slow-mo, lights flashing, people jumping up and down with pointed hands raised. Nothing's like that in real life. People are just standing around. Michael talks to a lot of people. He asks everyone about solitaire. We run into Rita, hanging quietly with a group of girls from my year. She sees me and waves, which means that I have to say hello to her. Hey, she says as I walk over to her. How's Charlie? Heard there was a fight or something. Ben Hope, wasn't it? Not much stays private in a town like this, so it's hardly surprising that everyone knows. It wasn't a fight, I say very quickly, and then clear my throat. Yeah, he's all right. Bruised, but all right. Rita nods understandingly. Ah, okay. Well, I'm glad he's not hurt too badly. After that, Michael and I end up caught inside a circle of Year 13s in the kitchen. Michael claims that he's never spoken to any of them. No one knows, like, no one knows who made it, one girl says. She has a very tight skirt on and a lot of unattractive red lipstick. There are rumours it's some dealer from the estate or, like, a teacher who got sacked and wants revenge. Stick around. Interrupts a guy wearing a snapback bearing the word jock. Like, keep checking the blog, innit? I've heard things are going to get well good when they put up the next post later. There's a pause. I look down at the newspapered floor, which isn't doing much to protect the house from the already numerous alcohol spillages. There's a headline on one sheet reading, 27 dead, and a picture of a burning building. Why? Says Michael. Why's that? But the guy just blinks like a fish and asks, why aren't you drinking? I decide to be a normal person and find something proper to drink. Michael disappears for a long time, so I pick up this big old bottle from somewhere and sit alone outside on a deck chair, feeling like a middle-aged alcoholic husband. It's gone 11 and everyone's drunk. Whoever's DJing relocates to the garden, and after a while it's unclear whether I'm in some small town garden or at a Reading festival. I spot Nick and Charlie through the living room window, kissing in a corner like it's their last day on earth, despite Charlie's bruised face. I guess they look romantic, like they really are in love. I get up and go inside to look for Michael, but whatever this stuff is that's in the bottle, it's kind of strong. So next thing I know, I've lost all sense of time, space, and reality, and I have no idea what I'm doing. I find myself in the hallway again, in front of that painting of the wet cobbled street with red umbrellas and warm cafe windows. I can't stop looking at it. I force myself to turn around and spot Lucas at the other end of the corridor. I'm not sure whether he sees me, but he quickly disappears into another room. I wander away and get lost in the house. Red umbrellas. Warm cafe windows. Michael grabs me out of nowhere. He pulls me away from wherever the hell I was, the kitchen maybe, lost in a sea of boy London hats and chinos, and we start to walk through the house. I don't know where we're going, but I don't try to stop him. I'm not sure why. As we're walking, I keep looking at his hand wrapped around my wrist. Maybe it's because I've had stuff to drink, or maybe it's because I'm really cold, or maybe it's because I'd sort of missed him while he'd been gone. But whatever it is, I keep thinking how nice it feels to have his hand around my wrist.